When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Crossover podcast, Chris Mannix, Howard Beck. What's up, Beck?
What up, my friend? It's a fine Wednesday afternoon, and I'm just trying not to feel snubbed. There's a lot of snubbery out there. I'm trying not to be part of the snubbery. I don't want to be snubbed. I don't want to snub anybody else. I'm anti-snubbing. I think we'll probably be talking about some snubbing.
Oh, it's that time of year, Howard, where the Devin Booker fan base is enraged. The Mike Conleyites are furious. The Tobias Harris Club is up in arms. The snubs for All-Star are just out there right now. And before we get too deep into the specifics of All-Star snubs, I have a message for players who take to social media and declare a player X to be a snub, the way LeBron James did and others have over the last 24 to 48 hours. If you're going to do that, that's fine. Your opinion is more than valid. But you also have to tell me who doesn't make the team. And Howard, you tweeted about this a day before, the day of the All-Stars being announced on Tuesday. You said to the fans, listen, if you're going to say player X was snubbed, you have to tell me which player Y is coming off the roster. And I say the same thing to the players, because don't let us in the media extrapolate what you mean. So, LeBron, if you say Devin Booker is the most disrespected or underrated player in the league, I guess what you're saying is that Zion Williamson doesn't deserve a slot on Team LeBron. I think that's what you're saying.
Maybe, maybe he meant Devin Booker should have made it over his buddy Chris Paul as the Suns rep. Who knows?
I got to tell you, and this is a separate topic. I've wondered a little bit in the last year or so about the LeBron-Chris Paul relationship. It came back to me when LeBron came out about the All-Star game.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, like, these guys purportedly are really good friends, and yet Chris Paul, who was the strongest advocate amongst players to have the All-Star game because he believed strongly in the money going to the HBCUs and other, you know, positives that come out of All-Star. And then here comes LeBron being the first to badmouth it and say, I don't know why we're even doing it. I wonder.
Maybe they coordinated it. Maybe it was like, Chris, you and I both know we need this thing. A lot of players are counting on that money too, so we'll do it. But, you know, we both know this also blows, so you go and push for it. I'm going to kill it, but don't worry, man. Like, we're good. But understand, publicly, I got to kill it. Like, I can see that. Those guys are savvy enough by far, by the way. They know how the game works. They could be.
I don't think it was that. I don't think it was that. I think there's something going on there between those two that maybe
your theory is more fun than mine. So that's cool.
Yeah. All right. So let's look at the All-Star selections from this past week. And I guess tell me, Howard, do you believe there is a legitimate snub? And if there is a legitimate snub, who is the player on either side that the snubby should be replacing?
Yeah. So I'm going to contradict myself right off the top, because there's a part of me that says, I've probably even tweeted this in past years, like, even the entire idea of a snub, it means that somebody was shut out of something, denied something that they were deserving of, and that, to your point earlier, like, well, somebody else has to go then. And my thing is, as long as there's still 12 slots, and we could talk about whether this should be expanded, somebody worthy is always going to get shut out. But that's part of what makes it an honor, Chris. It's an honor because there's only a finite number of these slots. If there are more guys who are deserving, than actual slots, that's a good thing. One, it means the league's in a good place talent-wise. Two, it means that getting it means something. And if you feel like somebody who was really deserving got shut out, it's not a reason to expand in, you know, every year, 13, 14, 15, 20. No, no, no. We want this to be an exclusive club. It's okay for some guys to possibly get shut out. Some of the guys who we'll talk about today are going to end up on all NBA rosters because with a full season, guys like Adebayo, probably Jimmy too, will climb back into that echelon, and all NBA is more important than All-Star anyway. So, like, I mean, there's a part of me that doesn't believe in the entire concept of snubs. Nevertheless, we are talk show hosts, and we must be incensed about something and guys getting shut out. And I do think there were at least, I would say, three guys over the two teams, East and West, who I thought had better cases than the guys who made it. And I'm not going to say anybody who made it was undeserving. I just think there are some guys who had stronger cases who did not get in. And I will get into this. I kind of question how the coaches select the reserves, because coaches are always telling us about how much winning matters. It's about winning. You got to win. I don't care. You got all these great stats. You got to win. And then they went and they picked Zach LaVine off a losing team, and Vucevic off a losing team, and Julius Randle off a losing team, and Zion off a losing team. Like, all right, coaches, I ain't listening to you ever again on this, all right? Stop telling me that everything is about winning, it's all just winning, and stats don't matter, it's just win, beat for the team, da, da, da. No, you just picked a bunch of guys off. And by the way, I don't have a problem with these guys making it. I'm just saying, you know, coaches, be consistent, or at least be more consistent than I'm being about snubs.
Yeah, if I'm looking at players I thought were legitimately snubbed, to me, it begins with Chris Middleton. And
yes,
Chris Middleton, who is statistically having a better season this year than he had last year when he was an All-Star. So, like, it's a little crazy that Chris Middleton can be better and not be an All-Star. And if I'm looking to swap someone out, it would probably be Zach LaVine, because Chris Middleton is on a winning team. He's a huge reason why they're winning. Whereas Zach LaVine, while the Bulls have played better as of late, and right now, as we record this, they are in that number 8 seed in the Eastern Conference. I would have probably flipped that one out. I say that, and I also want to say that I'm, you know, happy for guys making All-Star for the first time. The Bulls did a video with Zach LaVine where they brought in his parents and Jamal Crawford and friends and family, and it was really cool to see that. It's on social media right now. But Chris Middleton is a big contributor to a winning team. And I thought that was overlooked, to your point, by the coaches. Devin Booker, whether you want to flip him out for Chris Paul or Zion Williamson, I could have accepted that as well. You know, Bam Adebayo and Jimmy Butler, I think they were victims of Miami being so bad. Like, they had to be. Like, I think if Miami was, you know, sitting in the middle of the pack in the Eastern Conference playoff standings as this thing ended, they would have, one or both would have made the team. But the fact that Miami is a few games under 500, has not played or looked good all season long, I think that cost Adebayo and Jimmy Butler. The other guy I would say, and this guy enters the LaVine, Middleton, becomes the third member of this kind of trio for one spot, Fred VanVleet. Fred VanVleet has had an awesome season, and the Raptors have surged in the last, you know, couple of weeks. They had that awful start to the season, and they've played a lot better, and Fred VanVleet is a big reason why. So that's kind of like the three guards for one spot I kind of circled, Howard, when these came out. I don't really have a problem with Julius Randle, because the Knicks have been one of the surprise teams of the league, and Randle has been the driving force to that. So I think that those three guards and one getting it, you can reasonably quibble with that.
All right, so I got a bunch of things, but let me start with this just to kind of push back a little bit on a couple of things you said, even though all I right. agree on. First of all, the Heat, they were 7-14. They're now 14-17. So they've gone 7-3 over their last 10. Is that right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. They've gone 7-3 over the last 10, coinciding with Jimmy Butler getting back. They're still missing Dragic. Bam Adebayo has been great from start to today. The Heat have not been healthy. Jimmy Butler was out because of COVID. So if the coaches are going to punish Bam Adebayo and Jimmy Butler, who both were on the team last year, both were All-Stars last year, If we're going to throw them off because the Heat have not been as good lately, well then one, again, inconsistencies here because they took Vucevic, who's on a team that's even worse, and at least we know the Heat's rebounding. They're coming back. They're going to be in the playoffs. The Orlando Magic are going nowhere. Nowhere. Not now, not any time in the future that I can see. So, coaches, again, like, okay, if you're going to punish the two Heat All-Stars from last year because the Heat started off slow with injuries and COVID problems, then what are you doing picking Vucevic? What are you doing to picking LaVine, for that matter? So that's the first thing. While we're on that subject, if the standings matter, if win-loss matters, as you and I record this, the Heat are 14-17. The Knicks are 15-17, a half game better. So you'd rather go with Julius Randle because the Knicks are a half game better? You'd rather go with Zach LaVine on a 14-16 team?
Hang on the Knicks. The Knicks aren't, that's like 15-17, great! Heat, 14-17, boo. Like that, they're in different places, you know what I mean?
But that's a problem. But you can't, we're not judging on a curve or like the Knicks are doing better than expected, so we're going to reward them with an all-star berth.
But who has more help though, right? Like, you know, Julius Randle is not necessarily a one-man band there, but
sure,
you could certainly make the case that on paper, whether it's Tyler Hero, Duncan Robinson, Butler when he's healthy, Bam Adebayo has way more help.
Oh, absolutely, which is why they were the Eastern Conference champs last season, which is why we consider them a disappointment now. I'm not saying you strip away all context, but again, if that's part of it and we're not going to punish guys for bad teammates, well then, are we punishing Trae Young for the wrong reasons because the Hawks have underachieved, or are we saying it's actually Trae Young's fault? We don't have a consistent application of this, and that's probably all of us, by the way. Everybody has a little bit of a sliding scale, and you make exceptions for guys that you think were deserving on some other basis. The Raptors started out really slow, but they have recovered nicely, but they're still only 500. So, you know, if we're going to cape for Fred VanVleet, who I think was a worthy candidate, and then again, if it's about underachieving, Chris, or if it's about, do you have better talent around you and we're going to judge you based on that context? Well, then neither of the Celtics should make it. And I thought both Tatum and Brown should make it, and I'm glad they both did make it. But the Celtics, who I think we'll talk about later, are one of the biggest disappointments of the season at the moment, and both guys made it. So again, it's more about the consistency to me than anything and the lack thereof. So, all right, look, all that said, my two, I agree with you on Middleton, who I think should have made it. I do think Bam Adebayo should have made it. Bam's stats are just as strong as they were last year when he was a first-time All-Star. Plus, he plays defense. And I also think that there should be something to incumbency. Like, I think if you're going to knock out an incumbent All-Star, especially if he's playing just as well or better the following season, then you have to knock him out. And Bam Adebayo, if you want to compare stats with, let's say, I don't mean to pick on Julius Randle. Randle was absolutely deserving. All of them were. But would I have gone out at a bio over Randle? Yeah, probably. By the way, Julius Randle, almost identical stats to Domantas Sabonis, who also did not make it, but who was an All-Star last year. And so Sabonis doesn't make it, but Randle does. Their stats are like almost identical, like in every category they're within percentage points of each other. Their PER, I think, is exactly the same. And Bam is right in the same vicinity. He scores a little bit less than those guys, partially because he plays fewer minutes than those guys, but his efficiency is way higher than those guys. He plays defense at a completely different level than those guys. I thought Bam should have made it. I thought Middleton should have made it. And in the West, I absolutely would have put in Booker over Chris Paul. And by the way, since I have to hold myself to my own rule, if I were going to put in Middleton and Adebayo, I would probably toss overboard Vucevic and Randle. Not because they're not deserving, not because I don't like the Magic or the Heat or the Knicks, but just like those, like I don't think Adebayo and Middleton especially, man, like he's the number two star on a true contender, and he plays defense, and he's flirting with 50-40-90. And he's been an All-Star the last couple of years. Like, again, he was the incumbent. Why are we throwing him off because everybody fell in love with a couple of nice stories elsewhere? I don't know.
I don't even want to get into the Booker stuff because I think Booker's going to be on the team. Anthony Davis is not going to play.
Yeah, so that'll help.
Booker, I think, will be, the again, for the second year in a row, an injury replacement on the All-Star team. I kind of joked that James Jones should just like change the numbers on it or change the date on his statement from last year where he said, it, you know, Devin Booker is an All-Star. re-released it into the world. But Devin Booker is...
Quick sidebar on this. How do we feel about GMs, family members, agents issuing statements, or in the case of Terrell Harris, who is both Tobias Harris's father and his agent? I'm all for parents being proud of their kids and wanting them to succeed and everything, but like, don't go little league dad on this, especially when you're also his agent. It was really strange.
Maybe we should put a moratorium too on reporters asking for it. Don't ask for that kind of statement.
Yes, amen, hallelujah. Don't do that. Yes.
Are you expecting dad to say something other than my son should have been an All-Star? I mean,
who I also represent as his registered agent.
I mean, hell, Frank Ntilikina's dad probably says he's an All-Star. Everybody's like, whatever. It's fine. I would say this to kind of put a button on this, Howard. You see on social media, like, expand the All-Star rosters. I say no to that. Like, it should be an exclusive club. If you expand the All-Star rosters to 15 each and go 30 deep, it waters it down. It should be a difficult call every year, even if it's done to the best possible way. There are going to be things to quibble with. I think players wish it wasn't the coaches that made these. And I say that only because, I think the players would love to blame the media for this.
Why
are media members picking All-Stars? Well, it's not. There's no fan voting involved in this. This is coaches picking reserves. So if you have a problem with Devin Booker not making the All-Star team, if you have a problem with Mike Conley not making the All-Star team, with Tobias Harris not making the All-Star team, look at your coach. Ask him who he voted for, because that made the decision.
Well, and to that point, by the way, we have all sorts of transparency in all the awards voting these days. Like, our votes for postseason awards, everybody can see exactly how I voted, how you voted. I don't think they reveal how we voted on the All-Star, but we all made our ballots public anyway, a lot of us.
Yeah.
We know at least the order of how the fans ranked the All-Star starters. We know how the media ranked All-Star starters with our 25% vote. And we know what the players' votes were for their 25% portion of the starters. But the reserves are chosen by the coaches with absolute opaqueness. We have no idea whether a guy was close. We have no idea whether a guy was put at the front court spot and somebody else was in the wild card spots. We get no sense of what the ranking was. There's no transparency whatsoever. I don't expect that we're going to find out which coaches voted for who. That would tear apart the entire system and cause an outright revolt. But we should get at least a little more transparency about vote totals when the coaches vote. I think maybe that would be useful to all of us.
I'm with you. Open the floodgates. I say reveal all their ballots. Like, screw it. Like, we're getting our stuff revealed. I say, I want to know who Stan Van Gundy voted for. I want to know right now.
How about this? If we go 50-25-25 on the starters, fans getting 50% of the vote, players getting 50% or getting 25, and media getting 25, why not on the reserves have something similar? I'm spitting out words too fast. Why not something similar for the reserves?
I don't want the fan vote. I don't want the fan vote in the reserves. The fan vote is the reason Luka Doncic is starting the All-Star game and not Damian Lillard, who probably deserves a little bit more.
So go one-third, 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 players, coaches, media. I don't know. I think just having it in the hands of the 30 coaches who also can't vote for their own guy, so 29 coaches, and you only vote on your own conference, right? I think.
I'm not sure. I believe so, but
But you have a very small number of people voting on this, so a single vote swings a lot. I'm not sure that's the best way.
By the way, I know a lot of coaches that defer their All-Star ballots to their assistants.
Brad Stevens, Tom Thibodeau, Steve Kerr, they're not like sitting down poring over Basketball Reference for hours at a time like we are.
Tibbs might.
He's got no life, so.
Tibbs might. What else you do at 3 a.m. on a Tuesday but pour over Basketball Reference?
There's always more film for him to watch. There's always more film, probably from the mid-90s or, random, Grizzlies-Pacers game or something.
Real quick, if hypothetically, if Durant can't play, who would you replace him with?
Ooh. So we assume that Booker goes in for AD in the West. So in the East, if Durant can't play, and it might be a close call, my two snubs were Middleton and Adebayo. I think I go Middleton first because, see, here's the thing. I think, like, winning is a tiebreaker, right? I don't think it's the most persuasive factor, but it could be a tiebreaker. I think games played can matter as a tiebreaker. I think defense can matter as a tiebreaker. I think I go Middleton. I think Middleton for Durant.
I think it all depends on where the Heat are when that decision has to be made. As you said, the Heat have been surging as of late, 7-3 in their last 10. They've won three straight as we record this. If Durant pulls out, like, you know, March 5th or whatever it is, or March, like, if he decides not to go or play a couple of days before, and the Heat have won, like, six in a row and are now in, like, the sixth, seventh place in the standings, I think replacing Durant with Adebayo will have more momentum. I think that's probably true.
And by the way, quickly before I forget, I tweeted this a little while ago. Like, one of the unusual things about this year is the number of incumbents who fell out. Incumbent All-Stars who did not make it again. So, like, eight guys in the East from last year's All-Star roster did not get it this year. That's Kemba Walker, Trae Young, Siakam, Lowry, Butler, Middleton, Adebayo, and Sabonis. And it's in part because KD played and didn't play last year. Harden is now in the East, so that's a problem. And Kyrie barely had played, and so he wasn't it. So you've got the three Nets stars created a massive logjam. And then out West, Westbrook was in last year. He's now in the East, of course, but he's fallen way off. Brandon Ingram didn't repeat. Devin Booker, as of today, as of this moment, hasn't repeated, but maybe he will if Anthony Davis is out. But 11 guys out of 24 did not repeat. And part of that is some of this shift from West to East of these players. Some of it is health. Curry is back, so that took a spot in the West that was open last year. We have a real logjam. Again, I think that's generally a good thing. It's a good sign about the state of the league and the amount of high-end talent. And I'm fine with sticking at 12 men per conference. Like, if they went to 13, it's fine. I understand, like, the league's bigger than it used to be when they started off with 12s, but, like, there's not been a big push for this across the league. Like, this is not something the league office is necessarily eager to do or that players have necessarily even pushed for. So it seems like it's more of a fan desire than anything else, or maybe fans and media.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think there'll be any changes anytime soon, nor should there be with the All-Star. All right, that's enough talk about an exhibition game that's taking place in a couple of weeks. I want to talk, Howard, next about what's happening right now in Minnesota. It was just last week that we saw Ryan Saunders let go as the head coach of the Timberwolves. Saunders coached for parts of three seasons. I keep reading that he coached 3 years in Minnesota. No, he didn't. He took over for Tom Thibodeau and finished the season 2 years ago. He got most of last season's aborted year, and then this year he gets a month and a half with this team. So he's let go after coaching parts of three seasons. Fine. You can certainly make an argument that, you know, Ryan Saunders did not have the ear of the team and a coaching change was needed. Where things got complicated is the decision to hire Chris Finch, the Toronto Raptors assistant, who was announced mere hours after Ryan Saunders was let go, suggesting, if not outright, you know, determining, that this had been in the works for days, if not weeks. There are multi-layers here, Howard. One, not a great look to hire a coach off another staff just hours after you let go of your coach. Not a good look for Gerson Rosas. Not a good look for Chris Finch. You don't want to be seen as a guy that is going hunting for another coach's job. And I can tell you from talking to multiple head coaches in the last couple of days, that has not gone unnoticed. The other part of this is that in hiring Chris Finch, the Timberwolves passed over David Vanderpool. Now, if you don't know David Vanderpool, he is a very well-regarded assistant coach. He was in Portland for a long time. Now he is in Minnesota as their associate head coach. He is also African-American, which, you know, you would think that a team would want to offer an opportunity to a coach with those type of qualifications the chance to be elevated to interim coach, as often happens in these types of situations. The National Basketball Coaches Association on Tuesday weighed in, adding their criticism to what happened with the Saunders, you know, Chris Finch, David Vanderpool situation. So, Howard, I just kind of laid it all out there for you. Give me your reaction to what happened in Minnesota and how fair do you think the criticism is of the Timberwolves?
The criticism is absolutely fair. It's warranted. It's necessary. You know, it's funny because we look at these things as broad trends usually, right? And I wrote about this. It's been almost 6 years, actually. I wrote about this at my previous place of employment about the decline in the number of black head coaches, right? It peaked in the NBA with 14 out of 30 in, I think it was 2012-13. And then within a few years, it was less than half of that. And it has hovered in the 6 to 7 range, maybe it's hit 8 a couple times ever since. And we always look at it as this broad thing. Well, it's a trend, right? There's not enough representation in a league that is 75 to 80% black players. We don't see the same representation in coaching, in head coaches. We don't see the same representation in front offices. But it's often looked at as this broad league issue. But it's really a series of decisions by 30 different franchises, making decisions every year as they fire people and hire new people. And it's all those individual decisions that make up this broader trend. And it's not that often, Chris, that we get one like this where it's so vivid. Because teams usually, they bring in 6 candidates, a dozen candidates, sometimes more. And we see the process. We see the names leak out. We see who they considered. And most teams, to their credit, do a good job of considering a wide variety of candidates of differing backgrounds, different experiences, different ethnicities, everything. This is a case where there was no process at all because they fired and hired within seconds of each other. It was clear that based on the fact they had an agreement with Finch in hand the same night that they fired Saunders, that clearly they'd been working on it for a while. There was no interview process. They have tried to wave that away by saying, well, pandemic, hard to do, mid-season, blah, blah, blah. But David Vanderpool was right on their staff. Now, unless they have seen something in David Vanderpool that's suggested to them that he's not head coaching material, which would run contrary to everything we've heard from players and fellow coaches over years that he's been in the league. And we saw Dame Lillard and CJ McCollum both tweet on his behalf the other night. Unless they know something that suggests that they shouldn't elevate him, even on an interim basis, which, by the way, that's normally the course. Elevate the guy on an interim basis. If he does well, you keep him. You reward him with a multi-year contract. If not, you go hire Chris Finch in the offseason, or you hold an actual search in the offseason and interview multiple candidates in the offseason. You don't just do this. And it was highly unusual and interesting, and I think good, that the Coaches Association actually weighed in on this. They don't weigh in on this kind of stuff. They sometimes will weigh in on broader issues for coaches, but not a single hire or a single change of coaches. And they actually said in their statement, we would be remiss not to acknowledge a deeper concern and level of disappointment with the Minnesota head coach hiring process. I don't think I've ever seen the Coaches Association make such a strong statement on a hiring or firing decision like this. So it's definitely an issue, Chris. And I think it's helpful actually having something that's this obvious of one, so that instead of us talking in generalities about large trends and there's this number of black head coaches and it's down to this, or here's the turnover. Instead, we've got a very vivid example of where the problem sometimes is. And in this case, it is, and this often happens, a GM hires or a team president hires the guy he already knows. And that's fine. You want a guy you can partner with, that you trust, who shares your vision. I get that. But if guys are always doing that, then you're going to have a lot of generally white GMs and white team owners hiring white people because that's who there is in their social circles or the guys that they're closest to in the league. Gerson Rosas is Latino. In his case, he is, I think, very sensitive to these issues. It's part of, I think, why there was a lot of disappointment that he made this decision with this flawed process, because he certainly, as much as anybody, should understand the concerns about minority representation. And so you know, but that's the problem when people are just left to just hire the people that they already know. You don't go outside of your circle. You don't go outside of your comfort zone. And it often, not always, often results in hiring people who look a lot like you do.
The wildest part of all this for me is that it was completely avoidable. Chris Finch has been an NBA assistant coach since 2009. He had a stint with the Rio Grande Vipers, a successful one is that, as the head coach there beginning in 2009. He has coached for four different NBA teams, now five with the Timberwolves. I offer that as a preamble, as evidence that Chris Finch was going to be there in the offseason. Chris Finch was going to be available to hire the second the Timberwolves season ended. And given where the Timberwolves sit in the standings, their season was going to end as early as possible. So if the Timberwolves had gone the traditional route and just elevated the top assistant, given David Vanderpool the opportunity to coach the team for the rest of the season, what Gerson Rosas wanted, which was Chris Finch, would still be there. And you wouldn't be facing this type of backlash. And who knows? Maybe Vanderpool would turn out to be the guy. Maybe he would have a connection with Karl Anthony Towns and Anthony Edwards. One thing that Vanderpool does well is connect with players. You saw that, as you mentioned, with the tweets from CJ McCollum and Damian Lillard. He's got a good relationship with players. I can't speak to his coaching acumen. I have no idea if he would be a successful head coach. But Howard, there would be no downside whatsoever to elevating him for the final 40-some-odd games, and if it didn't work, hiring Chris Finch a week after the season ended, when Chris Finch is most likely going to be still working for the Toronto Raptors at that time. This was a bleep storm that was created, not one that just kind of spread out of nowhere. This one was created, and it was avoidable.
It was avoidable, and they also should have known. Like, how do you not see the flaws in this, and how do you not see it coming that you're going to get this kind of backlash? And again, a justifiable backlash. You have to be more aware than that as a franchise. And as the individuals in that front office, when you're having this discussion, hey guys, what are we going to do? We're losing. Is it time to fire the coach? Yeah, I think it's time to fire the coach. Okay, who are we going to get? Oh, well, I want to hire Chris Finch. Whoa, 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 hold on a second. Where was the person to say, whoa, whoa, hold on a second. Is this a proper process? And by the way, even if we think this is our best option, have we fully considered all the ramifications of it and what position it's going to put us in and what it's going to convey to the league? Into the public. I just want to note this too, Chris. The Minnesota Timberwolves have been a franchise for 32 seasons now. 32 years. They've had three black head coaches in 32 seasons. And one of them, Sam Mitchell, was only elevated to the position because Flip Saunders died on the eve of the season a few years back. I think it was in 2015. And so Sam Mitchell was immediately elevated, essentially as interim, and then replaced after the season. So I don't even really count him. He wasn't the result of a search in which they went out and picked Sam Mitchell. So it's really two in 32 years. Dwayne Casey and Sidney Lowe. And Sidney Lowe, well, that was like early on in the Timberwolves' existence. Dwayne Casey was fired in 2007. So it's been 14 years since they set out to hire a coach and decided on a black head coach. Again, Sam Mitchell, all due respect to Sam, he was elevated when Flip Saunders died, and they immediately replaced him after the season. So they really haven't done, like, it's been 14 years. They've hired, like, seven straight white guys. This franchise as a whole, I don't mean to pick on them. And by the way, Gerson Rosas just got there a couple years ago, so this is not necessarily on him. I think it is fairly on Glenn Taylor, who's owned this franchise for, I don't know how many years it's been now, but the majority of their existence. So, you know, at a certain point, we have to start looking at certain team owners and the people that they've hired and not hired and the decisions those people have made on their behalf. And I think it's fair to turn the spotlight on the Timberwolves right now as a team that has failed in this regard more than most of their peers.
It just seems to me that it is such a self-inflicted move. You elevate David Vanderpool, and not only do you give yourself options in case he's successful, but from a PR perspective, if that's important to you, you also generate the goodwill of being the first team to give David Vanderpool a head coaching job. It really would have been no downside. I mean, what does Chris Finch gain over the final 40 games of a bizarro season where you don't have a lot of practice time? Your second best player is out for the next month or so with a knee injury, and who knows what he's going to look like when he returns. And let's be real, Howard, is it going to surprise you one bit if we see Tankapalooza going on in Minnesota over the next couple of months? Remember, the Timberwolves, that draft pick they have is top three protected. If they don't finish inside the top three in the lottery, that pick goes over to Golden State. So they want to hold on to that draft pick going into this year's class. So somebody's going to have to explain to me what the upside was of bringing Chris Finch into the organization now as opposed to 3 or 4 months from now.
Yeah, I don't know. By the way, I just looked it up. Glenn Taylor's owned the team since 1994, so all but their first 5 years of existence. So a lot of this is on him, by the way. I think it's fair to say that.
I agree. All right, let's talk about DeMarcus Cousins, who is now officially a free agent after being released by the Houston Rockets. I thought our colleague Kelly Iko with The Athletic laid out the Cousins situation pretty good. And not to boil Kelly's story down to a couple of sentences, I encourage everybody to go and read it. But what it really comes down to with Cousins is offense good, defense bad. Like, that's basically what it comes down to with DeMarcus. He still has shown some signs of life offensively, but defensively he is even more of a liability than he was a couple of years back when he was fully healthy. So I'll ask you this, as a free agent, what do you think the market's going to be for DeMarcus Cousins, and how much of an impact do you think he will have or can have on a contender?
I think it's telling that within hours of the news that he would be released, we had reporters in multiple markets of teams that have been tied to Cousins speculatively, with reports saying, sources say the Lakers are not interested. Sources say the Warriors aren't interested. Sources say, what was the third one? Dallas, not interested. So like three teams that have a need at the position and that would be logical landing spots. There was immediately reporting from local reporters who, of course, you know, turned straight to their front offices that they covered and said, hey, are you guys in this? And the answer seemed to be no. I've not
which
heard
isn't, which isn't, by the way, to be fair, isn't always the reflecting
of
the opinion
course.
Of the reality.
Of course, but I think in a case like this, that's usually a team, you know, tipping it off to the local beat guys, that guys don't worry about this. This isn't the road we're going down. I have not heard those denials from the Nets yet, which is why Brooklyn continues to be tied to DeMarcus Cousins. Look, this is tough because DeMarcus Cousins was an all-star, a phenomenal player, an elite talent, but he's been through an Achilles, which on its own could end a career, and then an ACL, which on its own at a certain point in time in this league was really career threatening, or certainly would you might be a lesser player afterward, and he's a seven-footer besides.
With so a quadricep injury mixed in between.
And a quadricep. Yeah, thank you for reminding me. Like, that's like any of those on their own is enough. And he's a seven-footer who carried too much weight even in his prime, who even at the time that he was at an elite level, people knew, you know what, he should be slimmer. He doesn't stay in good enough shape, which was part of the reason that he was never a good defender. When he was at his best offensively, he could be a subpar defender and maybe get away with it, although he never did lead the Kings anywhere. And he was off to a decent start with New Orleans before, you know, the Achilles blows out. I think he's pretty close to done, to be honest. And when I say done, I don't mean like he won't be in the league. I just mean that if a team's picking him up, if the question is, well, what can he do for a team? What can he do for a contender? Not much. He can play limited minutes as a backup. That's all you're going to want. He's not a big rotation guy. I talked to a couple scouts who watched him recently, and one of the things that struck them was like he's basically just out there jacking up shots, and he's jacking up long-distance shots. He's not even trying inside. You know, a couple quick stats to throw at you. I know you're a big stats guy, Chris. I know you love when I cite Cleaning the Glass, Ben Fox, amazing site.
CTG, baby.
CTG. Reminds me of was it Shaq or Rashid or both of them who used to say CTC? That was Shaq. Cut the check. Mm-hmm. CTG is not that. Something different. DeMarcus Cousins is shooting 43% at the rim. 43% at the rim among bigs, that places him in the second percentile. Not he's in the top 2%. That's the bottom 2%. 98% of all players classified as bigs by Cleaning the Glass are shooting better than DeMarcus Cousins at the rim. He's a 7-footer who is known for being this powerful physical specimen who's an incredible athlete, and he's shooting 43% at the rim. That's a bit alarming. He's also not shooting much at the rim because, as I alluded to, he's jacking up a lot of longer distance shots. He's 79th among centers in real plus minus, defensive real plus minus, last I checked. He was never great in that category anyway, and he's been on a decline for years. He's just not a plus player, Chris. The Rockets were minus 5.7 points per 100 possessions with him on the court. He hasn't had a positive plus minus since that 2017-18 season when he was with the Pelicans. He's just not a plus player. Now, if you get him out there for 10 minutes to just soak up some time, apply a few fouls, maybe get a couple of shots around the rim if he can make them, fine. But, like, I just don't see, based on everything I just laid out, where the value is for him right now.
Yeah, as I survey the NBA landscape, Brooklyn just seems like the only team that would take a flyer on him. And I base that less on inside knowledge of what's going on in the Nets front office than what my eyes are showing me. And my eyes have shown me that the Nets will sign anybody because they have been signing everybody. They sign Iman Shumpert off the street. They sign Andre Roberson off the street. Now, they just let both those guys go, but they're bringing them back on 10-day contracts, all a financial move at this point. So the Nets are willing to bring in bodies and see if those bodies can have an impact. There's obviously a familiarity with Kevin Durant. You know, Cousins spent that ill-fated season with Golden State with Durant on the roster there. So maybe there's some chemistry, a connection with Durant, but I don't see any other team in the league taking a flyer. I initially thought the Raptors might. I have been convinced otherwise. If you look across at the contenders, if the Lakers don't jump on him, if the Clippers don't jump on him, you know, the Bucks are certainly not going to jump. Like, there aren't a lot of teams. I thought the Heat might consider it because, you know, Pat Riley, if he sees even like a modicum of talent, he just grabs the guy and says, I'll deal with the rest. But I'm not so sure I see that happening either in Miami. So I do think, and it's more of an educated guess here, I do think at some point Cousins winds up in Brooklyn. If he finishes the year there, I don't know. Like, it may just be one of those things where, like, all right, let's see if you compliment DeAndre Jordan. Maybe we can stop playing Jeff Green so much as an undersized five, and, you know, we'll see if Andre Drummond gets bought out. And if he does get bought out, then we're gonna kick you to the curb and say goodbye.
By the way, that's the thing. Like, if I'm the Nets, okay, yes, they're desperate for size. They could use another beefy 7-footer, even one in as bad a condition as Cousins after all of his injuries. Maybe 10 minutes a game from Cousins is an upgrade over more Jeff Green or other small ball options. But at some point, Drummond's going to be loose, I think. I don't think he's getting traded. I think we've established this. Drummond's going to be cut loose at some point. Do you want to hold out that roster spot for him or for JaVale McGee, another Cavalier center who I would think might be available at some point? So somebody else we haven't even thought of that might hit the market. I just don't know if Cousins is he's not the best of the, if even those three options. Like, I'd rather have Drummond or McGee. And there's competition, right? Like, the Celtics need help at center, and the Raptors need help at center. The Warriors, the Lakers, there are enough contending teams that could use another big man that, you know, even if there are going to be better options than Cousins, he might be the only guy you can get if you're one of these teams. So that's why I say, like, it's not over for him. He'll land somewhere, I'm pretty sure. I just don't know that there's a lot left to get out of him.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, that's been pretty much laid bare over these last couple of years. He might be able to put up a couple of numbers in spurts, but defensively he's probably going to give up a lot more than he gives you on the offensive end of the floor. Let's finish, Howard, with Boston. And as we record this, the Celtics have slipped under 500. Yeah, that's
right. Are they rioting in the streets up there yet?
They're not rioting in the streets. They are calling for the job of Danny Ainge. They are calling for the job of Brad Stevens. They are, at least on my Twitter account, suggesting a million hypothetical trades that will improve this team with nobody being off limits. But right now, Howard, the Celtics are a half a game from being out of the playoffs right now and in a congested field there in the middle of the Eastern Conference playoff pack. I've got some thoughts on this. Let me hear your thoughts first. Like the Celtics' problems, do you pin them on Brad Stevens? Do you pin them on the roster? And where do they go from here? Give me your ideas on that.
Well, let me start with this. Celtics fans, exhale. Go grab a Dunkin'. Get a couple of jelly donuts, a nice cup of Dunkin' Donuts coffee. That's what you people do up there, right, isn't it, Chris?
No, we don't eat jelly donuts, though. Drink Dunkin'.
All right. A glazed donut? No, I don't know.
Just go with Dunkin' talk. Like, say, get some Munchkins.
There you go.
25 Munchkins.
Take a deep breath. Relax. Grab a lobster roll. I don't know.
You gotta stop.
I love lobster rolls. I miss going to Boston getting a lobster roll.
Just say clam chowder. Just say clam chowder.
Chowder. I just don't think. I understand. Look, I'm not going to downplay the fact that they're underachieving. I'm not going to try to pretend that they're not. I don't know that it's time for outright panic in the streets and firing everybody. Brad Stevens, a few years ago, y'all wanted to like put a statue of him next to the Red Auerbach statue, you know, out in Faneuil Hall, right? Like, I'm placing him in the right place, right?
Yes.
So he didn't all of a sudden become less of a genius. Maybe he never was quite as much of a genius. I don't know. He's still a really good coach. He's fine. It's not about Brad Stevens. It might be a little bit about Danny Ainge in the front office. I think that's more to the point. I do think that losing Gordon Hayward, not replacing him, the trade-off of even Terry Rozier for Kemba Walker, not looking good at the moment. But, you know, look, injuries happen. Kemba's knee is an issue. This is still the same front office, though, that assembled all these guys and that got Jaylen Brown and that got Jason Tatum, two of the best young stars in the league, who both just, of course, were selected All-Stars. There's a great top-line talent, but not great second and third line talent there. The roster is, you know, there's a big drop off there. And losing Hayward and not having a fully functioning Kemba Walker or a diminished Kemba Walker is hurting them. But I don't understand how people have lost sight of the fact that Marcus Smart is no less than the fourth most important player on this team, maybe even the third most important player on this team, and has been out for weeks, and they've mostly been falling off and losing games since he went out. He's not just a great defender. He's a pace setter. He's a tone setter. He is, I think, their emotional compass. And he's their leading playmaker. He's their leading assist guy when he's out there. So, and the drop off from him to the next guys is steep. So, you know, do they need reinforcements? Yes. Could the front office do a better job of kind of, you know, supplementing these guys? Maybe. You know, I don't know what, you know, you've got the trade exception there, that massive trade exception. You've got picks. There are moves that can be made. I can't sit here today tell you exactly what that move is. There are moves that can be made. They're not big on making in-season major trades. Maybe they do this time. I just don't think the panic is that warranted. I think when all is said and done, Chris, if they're healthy, this is still a team that we'll be talking about in that tier, if not with the Sixers and Nets and Bucks, then just a tad behind them. They're like the Raptors, who are also underachieving, but have steadied themselves recently, are a half game ahead of Boston right now. Toronto and Boston, those are two teams that have been kind of neck and neck the last couple years. They're both there. And I think the Celtics will be fourth, fifth in the East, maybe sixth where they are right now, but with a better record. They're not going to fall out of the playoff race. And I think they will steady themselves, especially when Marcus Smart gets back. I mean, I think it's fairly straightforward.
I agree with everything you said, but I also do believe it is panic time. I think it's it's red alert time in Boston because this team is not good enough to succeed at the highest level. The reasons for that, you can peel them back, Kemba being a lesser player, the lack of depth, but they are not good enough to compete for the Eastern Conference Championship, not with teams like Philadelphia, Brooklyn, Milwaukee sitting ahead of them. They cannot compete with those teams with the roster currently constructed. Now, that is not reason to fundamentally change a roster that is comprised of 20-somethings. You know, Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum are both under the age of 25. It is a long game you're playing with Boston with those two guys. But for this year, I sit here, Howard, and I'm looking at that big, fat $28.5 million trade exception, and I'm thinking, if you're the Celtics, you got to use it. You have got to package that trade exception with a first-round pick or multiple first-round picks and get a guy that can help you right now. For too long, this team has protected its cache of draft picks like they were one of Danny Ainge's children. Like they have been just holding on to them for dear life. And some of those picks have panned out. I mean, Peyton Pritchard looks like he's going to be a good player. I think ultimately Grant Williams is going to be a rotation player. But other picks haven't really panned out. I don't think anybody in Boston would recognize Romeo Langford if he was in front of them in a Dunkin' Donuts. That's how anonymous he has been because of injuries over the first couple of years. There have been some whiffs during this time with the Celtics. So you've got to use these draft picks as trade assets. And I'm going to take it a step further, Howard, because, look, if you have the ability to get one of those bigs out of Orlando, of course you go and do it. I think either Vucevic or Gordon would be productive with this Celtics team. But if those guys, it turns out the price is too high for those guys, what I would do is turn my lonely eye to Oklahoma City and say, Al, come on back to town.
Yeah.
Because in the anonymity of Oklahoma, Al Horford has turned his career around. I mean, we both watched him in Philadelphia last year. There were clear signs that Al Horford might be, you know, starting to really deteriorate. The three-point shooting, it wasn't there. He wasn't comfortable playing alongside Joel Embiid. He goes to Oklahoma City, where he is a full-time five, which he is at this point, and he has resuscitated his career. He's shooting the ball a lot better from three and from the floor. He's gotten some of that swagger back. And if you're the Celtics, is there any player that's out there and available? And he's very available. Oklahoma City likes what they're getting from Al Horford, but it's not like they're going to build around him for years to come. Is there any player that's available that makes more sense than Al Horford, who could seamlessly step into your rotation, who has played with the guys that are the core of your roster? Does anybody make more sense than that? I don't know that Al Horford makes them on the level of the teams I mentioned above them. But I believe that Al Horford in the Brad Stevens system playing the five is a major upgrade for this team. And you can't, Howard, let perfect be the enemy of good, right? You can't let, like, if you can't make a blockbuster deal that gets you a 25-year-old star that can join the group for this season and years beyond, you can't just throw up your hands and say, you know what? We'll try to use that exception in the offseason. You have got to improve this team right now. And in my opinion, Al Horford improves this team.
I agree. I mean, I don't know if there's any still bad feelings lingering from Horford's departure or any of that. But these things tend to be temporary in the NBA anyway. Everybody can get over this stuff. They'll be fine. And he's not the same player he was when he left. But he was a guy who could fluster Embiid a bit. One of the reasons why the Sixers wanted him to prevent that from happening again. And he's just a really smart veteran who's been around, seen everything, universally respected, still has some game, and there's really no reason for him to be playing or finishing out his years in Oklahoma amidst a rebuild. I mean, he's like Chris Paul a year ago. Al Horford, I'm sure, is great for the young guys that Sam Presti has assembled in Oklahoma, and they value him for that. That's fine. He's more valuable to the Boston Celtics. And I'm with you. He fits nicely into that trade exception. I'm sure Sam Presti will only ask for, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, 8 first-round picks from Danny Ainge as the price of doing business. I mean, that's the thing. Like, Sam has extracted, like, max assets out of everybody in every deal for the last couple of years. So, can you do it for the trade exception and one first? Is that enough?
Because the Celtics are hard capped, you'd have to throw like a Tristan Thompson in there too. He does fit into that trade exception, but the hard cap issues mean you have to add a player.
Good point.
Yeah. I would love to be a fly on the wall in a trade talk between Sam Presti and Danny Ainge. I mean, that's just like a war of attrition between those two. But I can't imagine that if you're offered a first round pick and minimal salary back in return, you're passing.
No, I'm being facetious, but yes. I mean, it shouldn't take much. This makes sense for both teams to the nth degree. I'm with you. When we're not in the room, these things get complicated in a way that we can't possibly understand sometimes. But trade exception, some cap fodder, and a first. I mean, done. That seems easy enough.
Make it happen, Boston. Bring Al back. B-A-B. That's the new motto if you're the Celtics. Because
can he get a lifetime like free Dunkin' pass or something with it? Free lobster rolls for life?
Hey, one thing about Boston, if you're succeeding on one of their sports teams, I don't think you pay for much in the city.
Yeah, it's probably true.
You pretty much are allowed to, you know, commit highway robbery in some of these bars and restaurants in the city. So that's the way it goes. Howard, appreciate it, man. Always good to talk to you. Let's do it again next week.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
All right, when we come back, my conversation with former Herald beat writer Steve Bulpet. All right, for the last 35 years, you have read Steve Bulpet's work in the Boston Herald, one of the deans of the beats across the NBA. Steve's first year off that beat was this year, and he's taking a little bit of time off now. He joins me, though, here on the show. Steve, I guess what year was your first year on the beat? 35 years ago makes it what?
Full-time was 85, 86. That's when I started at the Herald, right? So
how did you get on the beat?
I'd covered some Celtics before at like Salem News and Beverly Times places. And I got hired by the Herald. They were actually beefing up their Sports Monday, Sports Friday sections. And they got a hire. And I had been talking to the sports editor at the time, Peter Drumsta. And he basically, I was hired to be the backup person on the Red Sox and Bruins beats, which was, you know, you'd be at every home game, do sidebars, make the occasional road trip, travel during the playoffs, and all that. And so I got hired very end of September. I was going to start in October. And just before I started, the editor called and said, look, our Celtics writer's got a back problem. Can you take this road trip? Can you feel comfortable covering Celtics? I said, well, I probably know more about basketball than the other sports. So, yeah, it's not a problem. And so my first day on the job was to get on a plane and fly to Indianapolis for one preseason game, then L.A. for two preseason games against the Lakers at the Forum. And, you know, first time I'd ever been west of Chicago. So I dove right into it.
Yeah, and you're diving right into a beat where the team is ultra competitive, of course. I mean, that was during the Larry Bird heyday. And I would imagine, and you can tell me more about it, but the beat back then was ultra competitive as well. Like, you know, with, you know, the luminaries, you know, that covered the Celtics. And I would argue, and again, you can tell me if I'm wrong, that, you know, there's been more high profile people covering the Celtics over the years than any other team in the league.
I don't know. throwing that at me, I can't think of other people. I know the Lakers had a lot of people on their beat, Thomas Bonk at the time. But back then on the Celtics, there were four of us who traveled. Dan Shaughnessy from the Globe, Peter May from the Hartford Current, and Mike Fine from the Patriot Ledger, which also had like a news service. So they were, you know, like the Lynn Item had signed up with them and other papers around the Massachusetts, New England area, I guess. So they had a sports service going. So that was the four of us.
You know, what was it like then with the four of you covering that team? How competitive was it at that point?
I think it was competitive, but it was, you know, a lot smaller than it is. Like now you've got, you know, so many different outlets and websites and blogs and all this here. Back then it was a lot less formal. The team flew commercial. So like in the fall, the basic Celtic schedule every year for those first several years was Friday night home game, Saturday night road game. And you'd show up at the airport on Saturday morning, get on the same flight because you'd work through the same travel agent. And, you get handed your boarding pass. And on the next morning, on the Sunday morning, you'd show up at the airport again. And by the way, you're on the team buses from the airport to the hotel. Again, it was just a few of us. There are more assistant coaches and support staff now than were in the entire travel crew back then. But you'd show up at the airport, you'd get on a bus on Sunday morning. And if I remember knowing that if I had a couple of extra drinks out on Saturday night in Milwaukee or wherever we were, and I had to rush to the bus, I could always count on McHale to be just a little late and give me just a little bit of leeway there. But you'd go to the airport, show up at the gate in whatever city you were on the, getting ready to head home, and they wouldn't practice after the back-to-back. So you'd walk around. We would walk around the gate area and talk to players to get our off day story Sunday from Monday's paper. And, you know, it was really, you know, kind of informal. And you'd run into some really wild people at the airport. You'd get to a city and there'd be a bunch of Walton's friends meeting the flight. And that was always a trip. Just a lot more informal.
Yeah. How did players, how did they react to that? Nowadays people even, and I've been doing it, you know, 10, 15 years now, but like the idea of just kind of walking up to guys in the airport is, you know, you can't even dream of it at this point. What was it? How did they, how open were they in those situations?
You know, it's funny. Oh, very open. I mean, it wasn't an issue at all. What's funny, and I've talked to with Larry about this over the years, Larry Bird for you kids, and he liked when they he wished he could make when he was running the Pacers. He told me he wished he could make them fly commercial for a couple of trips a year, just so they could appreciate what they have, but also there was a lot better understanding. Media weren't people who parachuted in from outer space to get in their way. When you got to the airport in the morning, like on a Friday or a Saturday morning or whatever, and you dragged yourself to the airport, there was a sense among the players and the writers that, you know, the players would look at us and say, geez, you know, these guys are working for a living. You know, we were bedraggled and so were they. You know, they were from playing and we're from like chasing them around and all this stuff. And it was more of a working person environment. So I think there was just, it wasn't, things weren't so closed off. We'd show up to practice as they started and sit in the stands at Helena College, watch practice and talk to people afterwards. You know, and they managed to win championships that way. It was amazing.
What were the rules like in those situations where, how much deciding did you have to do about, you know, what makes it in the paper versus what doesn't? Nowadays, Steve, as you know, like let's say, for example, if there's a video of a guy in a bar the night before the game, that becomes big news. If you see a McHale dragging or a Bird dragging, and or something comes up where you find out that they've been out the night before, they play poorly. Like, what's fair game in those situations?
Well, getting back to the practice thing for a second, everything was fair game except you weren't going to write about the plays they were going through. You know, I mean, but if some guy hauled off and punched somebody, you know, it was going to make the paper. As far as the, you know, seeing a guy out, I had my rules. If I walked into a bar and saw a player, then I left because I didn't want to see what they were doing. And I didn't want to see, you know, I didn't want them to see, you know, me, you know, being stupid, which was a kind of a regular occurrence. It was funny. I remember one night, and I've mentioned this to Perk since, I was at this a place in Boston, a club in Boston. And I was talking to a very nice young woman. And I was young at the time, too, so it wasn't creepy, okay? and I, all of a sudden I see Perk. And it's like, I got my rule, but I don't want to leave this conversation I'm having. So I walked over to Perk and I said, look, I don't see you. And he looked at me and said, he smiled and said, yeah, but I see you. And I said, no, Perk, you don't understand. I don't see you. We don't see each other right now, okay? We're, you know. And took him a while, you know, because he's, you know. Anyway, but we got the point across. So, yeah, I would try to avoid situations because if I saw something, then, you know it. You can't run away from it. So in those situations – I wasn't there to write. I was there to write basketball. So, like when Larry got in that fight in the bar prior to me covering the team, in fact, it's funny. He and I talked about it over the years afterwards because I think he was mad at Shaughnessy for writing about it. And I told him, I said, hey, if it affected your play, then I'm writing about it, you know? And, you know, that because I'm here to write about basketball and everything that impacts basketball.
What's the story that sticks in your memory the most when you think back to those Bird, McHale, Parrish teams?
You know, there were so many. The day that Shaughnessy left the beat was a pretty funny one. but anyway, it comes to mind because Dan and I were just talking about it a couple weeks ago. But there's so many things. The Celtics-Lakers games, and just the odd moments, you know? And again, this one comes to mind because somehow it came up in a conversation recently as well. The yearly plan was the Celtics would play the Lakers in L.A. on the Sunday afternoon, the week after the All-Star game. It was like a big national TV game, and that was always a huge deal. And so I think it might have been 86 or 87. But prior to the game, Walton is walking around the dressing room. You know, he's got his uniform on and he's pounding his fist into his hand. Big one today, big one. You know, not talking to anybody, but just like, you know, big game today, big game today. And Bird is sitting like several feet away at his locker, lacing his sneakers and not paying attention to anybody there. He's in his own world. And he's just like a little kid. He's there, you know, kind of in a sing-song voice. We're playing the Lakers. We're playing the Lakers. And actually, I'm going to jump in with one more. And if it was the 86 game, then it was the Monday prior to that. The Celtics had flown, the Celtic All-Stars and stuff, we had flown from Dallas to Sacramento to start the post-All-Star road trip. And 86 Dallas was the first year of the three-point contest. And we get to the hotel in Sacramento, and it was one of the old Red Lions that's got the tentacles with the room, so everything's, you know, like a center – lobby. And anyway, so the team gets ready. They get there in the afternoon or whenever, and they go to practice that night. They put on their sweats and go to get on the bus. And as guys are coming to get on the bus, Larry is standing there with one of those dime store notebooks. And he had bet everybody on the team about when, that he was going to win the three-point contest. And Larry was standing there, and Larry was collecting. And it was hilarious because it was – and he's like, you know, I don't know if they're like $10, $15 bets back in or whatever. But Larry's standing there, and he's checking off the names. He goes, hey, where's the money? Get it up. Goes, come on, Larry, it's in my room. Come on, go get it. Go get it. They go, Larry, my room's like a mile away. They're going to wait for you. No, I'm the three-point king. You said I wasn't going to be the three-point king, but I'm the three-point king. I won. I'll go get your money. Go get it. Come on. They're going to hold the bus for me. They leave without the three-point king. Hilarious. I mean, he's standing there with a freaking dime store notebook checking off the names.
Love. I assume he got all his money.
I certainly hope so. Well, I anyone who didn't give him the money, I'm sure didn't see the ball the next night against Sacramento.
You know, you've chronicled and borne witness to some seminal moments, not just the highs of this team, but the lows. And, you know, one of the first lows I believe you covered was when Len Bias passed away in the mid-80s. What was it like covering that? And, you know, as we look back on it, you know, 30-plus years later, you know, what kind of impact did that have on the team, you know, the passing of Len Bias?
In a basketball sense, which is kind of crass relative to what happened here, but in a basketball sense, I think incalculable because that was 86. In 87, McHale plays through the playoffs on a broken foot. And Larry, all of a sudden, the defensive alignment changed entirely. And, you know, if you go in through Celtic history, one of the biggest things that made that team great was McHale would guard the opposing small forward, the big scorer. When the Celtics played Atlanta, McHale guarded Dominique Wilkins. Parrish guarded Kevin Willis. Larry got to guard Tree Rollins, who wasn't getting the ball. And so Larry could play passing lanes, and it just changed things. Remember, the big Dominique-Larry shootout was the next year when McHale couldn't, you know, after playing on the broken foot, and, you know, it was not going to be the same after that. So that's why you saw Dominique get off that much, because McHale couldn't be the one guarding him. So in that sense, yeah, you can look at all the ways, the branches from that one thing, but I think it kind of like signaled the start of the team is now running on lower gas as it plays out. Getting to the 87 finals was a major accomplishment. But from there it was going. I mean, Larry was injured. He had the Achilles and all those things and his back. So it was never going to be the same, but that was, the Len Bias situation was just amazing. I remember, I'm telling the editor, back then the draft was in the afternoon. It was a daytime draft in New York at Madison Square Garden in the Felt Forum, which is now, I think, the Paramount Theater now? They have boxing there and stuff now. So you'd know, right, whatever they call it.
The one out, where is it, in Long Island? Or
No, I'm sorry. In Madison Square Garden that, like
– Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, the theater. They call it just the theater, the Hulu Theater or whatever. Yeah, okay.
But it was the Felt Forum back then. And I remember telling the editor, Bob Sales had come on as the editor. And I said, well, look, I want to go down to the draft, because they would fly the guy to Boston anyway. But I said, I want to be there. I want to be the first writer that he talks to, that he meets. And anyway, they draft Len Bias. And I talked to him then, and we were walking out. It's Len Bias, his father, one of the agents, a representative from his agent, and Steve Riley from the Celtic front office. and we jump in cabs and go to LaGuardia, get on the Eastern shuttle and fly back. And I'm writing this whole thing. And I talked to his mom, and I, you know, that night for the next day's story and all these different things. And then the next morning, I get the phone call, you know, I'm out of a sound sleep, and Len Bias is dead. Well, first of all, I got a call from a friend saying, hey, Len Bias just died. And I said, come on, you're crazy. Like, I'm sure everyone's reaction was that. And then a couple of minutes later, the phone rings. It's my editor. Len Bias is dead. Get to Logan. You're on a flight to DC, leaving in like an hour. And it was a crazy day. We had a photographer and me and Andrew Miga, who is the Herald's Washington bureau person. And we wind up at, we go to the hospital, we go to the area where his dorm was, then all of a sudden they're gonna have a press conference at Cole Fieldhouse. And Lefty Driesell gets up on this podium and is talking in this in the lobby of the Cole Fieldhouse. And at that point, everyone thought it was like, I remember like Marfan syndrome or something like that, because Arturo Brown, a Boston University player, had something that had heart issue. But anyway, Lefty Driesell is talking, and I turned, and something is not adding up to me in the way he's talking. And I turned to Andrew Miga and say, go to the dorm. He goes, what? I said, something's screwed up here. Please just go to the dorm right now. Like, I got this covered. He goes down to the dorm and finds the police and investigators combing through the dumpster. So if we'd had Twitter back then, it would have been a nice Herald story. But yeah, it was interesting. It was odd. And the other thing I'll say about it is that night they got me a room at the Quality Inn in College Park, Maryland. And again, this is the end of my first year on the beat. And, wild year, Celtic won the championship, all these things happen, and now this. And, you know, again, I had talked to his mom and all these people, and it just really struck me, you know. And I, sitting in the room that night, and I said to myself, well, just, you know, now this is the worst thing you'll ever have to cover. And I should never have said that, because a few years later, it's Reggie Lewis. And not to, you know, quantify tragedies, but Reggie I'd known, you know? And so that was, never tempt fate by saying something as dumb as that. And not that I haven't said dumb things since, that one was, it just stuck with me.
Well, let's talk then about Reggie Lewis, because, I mean, the Celtics of the 80s and 90s, they were transformed by tragedy. I mean, Len Bias's passing changed the course of the franchise. Reggie Lewis's passing changed the course of the franchise. I guess, as a reporter, what was more challenging to cover, the Len Bias tragedy or what happened with Reggie Lewis?
Reggie Lewis. Again, there were more aspects to it. There were, the Celtics putting together the team of doctors that had diagnosed him, and the family not, understandably, not wanting to believe that. And no one wanted to believe that, hey, look, it's over. You know, be happy you're alive right now. Basketball, forget about it. That's what I meant by saying it's over. But then he goes to a different doctor, and then all the things that happened, the rumors, and some of the rumors that got printed, and which, you know, we won't get into the rumors, I guess, but involving drugs and things like that. But if you talk to, and Jim Calhoun is a friend of mine, and he'd been was he still the Northeastern coach, or had he gone to UConn? I'm not sure. But, you know, you talk to Jim today, and he will go crazy. He just goes crazy when people, you know, talk about the rumors that were surrounding Reggie and that got printed in certain papers, because, you know, he'll point out how that the heart issues were something that was in the Lewis family and, you know, had been there all along and was something that they, you know, had always been concerned about with Reggie, you know, even when he was at Northeastern. Hey, this is there's a family history of these things. And so anyway, that made the Reggie thing a lot more difficult. Yeah. But I mean, the in terms of impact on the league, the bias thing, I mean, I'll tell you the stupid stuff.
Let me go back to Reggie for a quick second. Sure. Like, you know, could you, like, and I do remember how that all played out. And, you know, spinning it forward 25 years, I mean, you almost can't imagine now a player basically shunning the opinion of a dream team of doctors assembled by the team and going with the opinion of one doctor. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know that situation could happen now. I don't know
I think it could.
You do? You think that, like, okay. I mean, it was definitely doctor shopping there for Reggie. And I don't know that, maybe I guess I don't know that, like, the team or the league would allow a player to play under the circumstances that the dream team of doctors said Reggie was playing under.
Well, as I recall at the time, they didn't know exactly what the issue was. They just said, hey, look, this is bad. You shouldn't be playing any basketball. And I remember at the time thinking and writing that among the scariest things in the world, one of them would have to be you're an athlete and you're in a hospital in Boston, one of the medical centers of the world, and you have all these renowned physicians examining you. And at the bottom line, they don't know precisely what's wrong with you. Like, that's got to be scary as hell. I mean, no matter what they tell you, if they know, okay, here's what it is, here are the treatments, here are the possibilities, but there was some uncertainty with exactly what it is in his situation. So I would wonder, like, how frightening that must have been for Reggie to be lying in a hospital bed in Boston and having smart people in the lab coat say, I'm not quite sure, but don't do this.
Yeah. I just wonder if nowadays, if there are, you know, that many doctors saying don't do this, if a team would even, you know, allow that. I mean, I guess it would be a fight if a player insisted on playing, but it just feels like that situation, the way it played out, it's hard to see it playing out this way.
Isaiah Thomas and his hip, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the Celtics allowed him to play, but, you know, what was smart and what was not smart in that situation? You know, how much, what did it cost him in terms of his career after that?
No question. It cost him his career, is what it did. I'm still, to this day, not sure Isaiah Thomas is ever going to make it back into the NBA. What's that?
I think he should. I think some team would be crazy not to bring him in.
Yeah. I guess, look, I think bringing him in is okay. I understand what he's been saying, and I've been watching these USA basketball games he's been playing. He's still offensively dynamic, but as you know, that doesn't really matter. Like, it's how big a liability are you defensively? And I think you have to see it to believe. I remember, and it's a little bit off topic, but I remember chronicling the Jay Williams comeback for years. You know, when Jay Williams, you know, had the motorcycle accident and he came back, and I remember calling different GMs of teams that he'd be working out with, and they'd all say, look, it's, you know, lateral movement. It's defense, defense, defense. And like, I, as much as anyone, we both, I think, would love to see Isaiah Thomas get another crack, because he's such a great person and a great story and has been through so much over the last few years, both professionally and personally. I just, you know, It didn't really work in Denver. It didn't really work in Washington. Maybe the latest operation, you know, helps him and has helped him and changed things for him. But it's like, you're going to have to show me. I'm going to have to see it to believe it.
Think of it this way, Chris. And when he was with the Celtics, Ainge's idea originally, and we had talked about it, was that Isaiah was built to be kind of a sixth man type. Come in, inject pace, inject offense, come in, fire away. And then they needed him to do more, and he did it. I mean, in terms of the Celtics getting from the Big Three era, the Pierce Garnett, Ray Allen era, to this next era, he was a huge part of that, made this team relevant to all these different things, made it a place where a free agent would want to come by making the team appear like it was on this upswing, which it was. So he'd be built for that role. The other thing you're talking about, I always find a little funny if you take it to a degree because, and again, we're going to go into the old fart file here. God, that is my best example. But when the Hawks would put Spud Webb into the game, you know, he pushed the pace. He would, you know, get fast breaks going. He would score all these different things. And teams would like, okay, we're going to take advantage of him. So now Isaiah Thomas comes into the game, and he's going to fire away, and he's going to drive to the hoop, and guys are going to collapse. He's going to find people, or he's going to get to the free throw line, whatever. And teams are going to say, okay, look, we're going to really take advantage of him. Well, you may be trying to do that, but you're not going to run your offense. Okay? He's going to take you away from what you want to do, what is your best plan, because all of a sudden – Now you're chasing him or trying to exploit him, and all of a sudden you're not running what's more comfortable to you. So I see your point, and over the long run, if he's playing 35 minutes in a game, yeah, I totally agree with you then. But if he's coming in for injections here and there, you can live with that, I think.
It's a good point, and I think I would expound on mine. In that, I would say I'm not sure that offensively Isaiah is what he used to be. I mean, I remember having a conversation with Micah Shrewsbury when Isaiah was, I believe, in Washington. I was just asking him, I was like, you know, what made Isaiah special as a player? And one thing he said, among several things, but was that he was always on the move. Like, he was always in motion, perpetual motion, like just, you know, side to side, back and forth. Like, he was just the Energizer Bunny out there. Wasn't that way after the hip injury in stops in Cleveland, LA, Denver, Washington. The other thing was, and you saw this statistically in DC, where a larger percentage of his shots were coming from beyond the three-point line. Where, I mean, God, you saw this, and I saw it, like, I mean, he was fearless in Boston. Like, going into the paint, creating contact, getting to the free throw line. It's what made him such a great fourth quarter scorer. Whether it was the explosion was gone, or that he was a little gun-shy because of the hip, he wasn't that player either. So I guess, you know, look, again, I don't dispute the idea that, like, you know, somebody takes a flyer on him, says, you know, bring him in, let's see what we got, short-term contract, rest of the year. If he can do all the things offensively, or at least close to it, that he was doing in Boston, yeah, it's absolutely, you're right, you can, you don't worry about the defensive stuff, you can hide that and use him in spurts. But if it's still the same issues offensively, where he's not moving as much and he's not attacking as much, that's a problem you just can't get past, I don't think.
I think what's happened, this discussion, the way it's turned, proves my point, because right now we're talking Isaiah and you're not running your offense. You're not running the conversation you wanted to have. So
no, this is the conversation I want to have. It's all of a sudden, you know, history. You know, yeah. So, I mean, to spin it forward then, you know, 35 years, you knew your schedule, or at least the craziness of your schedule. What's it been like to not have, I mean, none of us have really had the same schedule as we used to because of everything happened with COVID, but what's it been like to, you know, not be chronicling this team for the first time in 3+ decades?
You know, it's weird in that it doesn't feel like I'm missing a whole lot, that it's a whole lot different, because you're not covering the team the same way anyway. You know what I mean? So tweeting some stuff out here and there just to you know, keep my hand involved, and because I feel like it. I look at this as like a from a media standpoint, like an asterisk of a year anyway. You know, so it's like, yeah, tell me how much different my life would be, except I'd be having to be on the Zoom calls and transcribing quotes. But the real part of the job that we do that, you know, differentiates our work is our ability to talk to him, to pull a guy aside and talk to him, you know, after a difficult game and Marcus Smart finishes with his scrum in the locker room, you know, you give him a nod and he, you know, motions his head out to the hallway and you go out and talk to him out there and get, you know, a better story. That's not a possibility now. So again, you know, I don't feel like I'm missing a regular year. If this were a regular season and there were no COVID, first of all, I'd still be working at the Herald. You know, that would feel different, I think. But other than that, I'm, you know, it's what the coaches say, control the controllables, right? So even before the COVID layoffs came at the Herald on July 1st, you know, I was taking advantage of the not having to travel thing to just, you know, get healthier, you know, something that, you know, is not really possible to the degree we'd like during our usual NBA calendar.
Do you think, and you still are very much involved with the Basketball Writers Association, do you think we go back to the way it was when things settle down? Or, I mean, how much of this do you think is permanent, the way that, you know, the league is now having media cover it?
Well, yeah, I'm still on the board with the PBWA, and all I can tell you is that we've been assured by the league that these are situations based on the situation, based on the pandemic. So, you know, for years, the PBWA has been fighting about over-credentialing. You know, and we'll see how if they start limiting things, and we're not talking about credentialing too many, you know, regular media types, but there, you know, our issue has been with the teams aren't happy that some things get put in on sites, and it's their fan sites, and they're not people that have bosses that, you know, have structures. So anyway, we've talked about that in the Players Association. They're not happy with the overcrowding in locker rooms, you know, that we see now. And it's what gets missed is the opportunity to talk to a player, to get a guy aside privately in a dressing room and even have a conversation that's not necessarily a quote unquote interview. Just have a regular conversation that, you know, fosters the business relationship that turns into something else down the line, you know, when all of a sudden it makes it easier to approach a player or the player to trust you because you started to get to know each other, you know, in that regard. Mm-hmm. So who knows? But the league is, to answer your question, the league has assured us again that this is just based on the pandemic.
Yeah, that'll be good because it's exceedingly difficult to do the job like this, for sure. I mean, for all the reasons you laid out, you know, not being able to pull a guy aside or just be around. I mean, I said this on an earlier podcast, but I went to a game in January and I have no reason to go back. You know, sitting there from the press seat, watching behind plexiglass with no access to the coaches on the floor or the staff members that we've grown to become friendly with over the years, it doesn't add anything to the equation there. Do you have, Steve, you've watched this team, you've kept up with it, of course. Do you have a solution for their current problems right now? I mean, we've got Danny Ainge, people calling for his job. I've been asked by different people, should Brad Stevens be fired? I mean, it seems like, and you've seen different degrees of panic in Boston, it seems like we're now approaching, I don't want to say a critical mass, but it's a high point for frustration.
Well, I had two questions coming into this year. And the first one, I think I did a Twitter thing about it earlier. The first one was whether this team would get away from hero ball. Because if you look at how it has lost over the, how it's been eliminated over the last few years, that's been why they've lost. You can go back to 2018, game seven at home against Cleveland, which, you know, subconsciously knew it was going to get croaked by Golden State in the finals. And what's funny is that Golden State really wanted to avoid the Celtics. They much rather, they got what they wanted by playing Cleveland. But anyway, you get to that game seven and a couple of bad possession, things start to go bad. And players are saying, okay, I'm going to take the ball and I'm going to go make a play. And then that turns into hero ball. One-on-one becomes one-on-two, one-on-three, and you've stopped running your offense. You're not getting easy shots. The shots you make are ridiculously difficult. You're not making the defense move side to side or work. And that's continued. It's you can look at it and say that's why, if you up to last year, how they went so long in certain series that they shouldn't have gone long in, and how they ended up losing to Miami. They should, you know, generally speaking, in the NBA, in the seven-game series, the better team wins. And I don't think the Celtics – I don't think Miami was the better team than the Celtics last year. You know, they stuck to their – they played their game better than the Celtics played their own. And so that was the key question. Would guys get away from that? And what we've seen is the big killer for the Celtics this year is that too many times, especially in critical situations, no ball movement, no cutting, and all of a sudden the game goes out the window. So taking that and saying, okay, whose fault is that? Do you think Brad Stevens is telling them, hey guys, stop cutting, stop passing. Just take the ball, and if you got it, go make a play. No, it's guys going off in the world. And it's not to say they're being jerks about it. They're trying to accept responsibility and go make a play. So their heart's in the right place, but their head is in their nether region, because that you've taken yourself away from what you do well. And how you know this is, think about the times this year when the ball has moved side to side and got the defense out of position, and they've gotten easy baskets. Think about how much better a Jason Tatum and a Jaylen Brown are as finishers. You know, not five dribbles to get to the basket, catch and finish. And that's the beautiful basketball that they play. So that to me is like, there's your solution, number one. And the second thing I had coming into the year was, you know, tell me how far Robert Williams is going to develop. And, you know, is he going to be just a guy that shows flashes, or is he going to be someone you can start to count on? And I think that's a huge issue for this team, was interior defense. You know, that's been an issue for quite a long time now. And I think he's answered that question in the positive. So, you know, the solutions to their problems they have in their dressing room right now. And I think it's not hilarious. I think it's kind of sad that people will jump on a Brad Stevens saying, you know, he doesn't have control of the team. They're not listening to him. If you're a player and you know what you're being told works, and it's better for you actually too, because your shots that you're going to get are going to be easier and you'll be able to score. You'll still be able to score your points. But if you're not doing that, who's the problem here? Is it the coach or is it you? Again, you might have your heart in the right place, but you're screwing up. So, you know, as far as Ainge goes, yeah, last year I would have liked to have seen him bring in Jamal Crawford. You know, I thought that would have been a good move. But and has he been a little bit – has Danny been a little possessive with some of his younger guys toward the end of the rotation or into the bench? Perhaps. You know, but bringing a guy in like a Jamal Crawford last year, those are the kind of things I think can help. But so what's wrong and what can fix it? You know, I think they can find the Celtics can find the answer to that in a series of mirrors. You can just go up to the mirror and look at it and say, okay, here's your problem and here's your solution.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think that Danny Ainge or Brad Stevens is the significant problem or part of the problem here. It's the way they're playing right now, and that's primarily on the players that are there.
Steve, are we supposed to disagree so we can like argue?
I mean, I guess it's on a debate show, but I guess on a podcast we're allowed to agree. Steve, appreciate your time, man. Always good to catch up with you, and I hope to see you back out there real soon, man.
I think you will.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.